So Charlie Stango was getting out of prison after his murder bid. He served his time. He's on parole. And his nephew Jimmy had came to me. He wanted to trump Louie. And he says, look, you know, my uncle's Charlie Stango. So I'm like, I don't know who that is. Who's that? Well, you know, he's a captain. He's a captain. He's a cop? No. He's in the military? You say he's a captain. What's he a captain of? No. He's a capo. And again, I made him work for it, right? And I go, so what does that mean for me? That doesn't mean shit to me. No. You don't understand. If I could get my uncle to vouch for us, he's back in the street. He just got out for, you know, he did a murder bid, and he pitched it to me. And I said, so what do we get out of it? He says, well, we can make money. My uncle says we can sell this stuff in the street that you have, you know, all these boots and these shoes and these all this cigarettes. We could sell them at union sites and construction sites. I said, yeah, well, you know, whatever. I said, but I don't have a mouse in my pocket. You know, what's this wee shit? You know, like, I'll give you a cut, but you got to hustle. So when Louis saw that, now Louis wanted in. Now Louis all of a sudden wanted to do business with me. And then before you know it, Charlie Stango came calling.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Our guest today is former policeman and DEA and FBI undercover agent Giovanni Rocco, who grew up on the rough streets of Bayonne, New Jersey. He's here to talk about the critical role he played in Operation Charlie Horse, which ultimately brought down several high-ranking members and associates of the infamous New Jersey Di Cavalcanti Mafia family, the organization known as the Real Sopranos. Giovanni's infiltration into the Di Cavalcantis went deep, so deep that after 2.5 years undercover in the company of violent mobsters, as he was pretending to be a thief named Giovanni Gatto, the wise guys were talking about making him a made man. At the time, Giovanni was married to a wife who was in law enforcement and was raising a family. His incredible story is chronicled in the critically acclaimed book, Giovanni's Ring, My Life Inside the Real Sopranos. It's my great honor to welcome former FBI agent Giovanni Rocco as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Tell us a little bit about your background, because you grew up in Bayonne, New Jersey, which, if listeners don't know New York City, Bayonne is like right across the tip of Manhattan. It's almost in the city. I mean, you guys are like staring down its throat there.
We are. I mean, it's part of the city, right? It's how we grew up. But Bayonne, when I grew up there, was a self-sustaining town. I describe it as being very Brooklyn-esque.
Yeah.
You know, when I grew up there in the 70s and 80s, you didn't leave Bayonne. You know, you stayed within our community. If you really had to venture out, you went to Journal Square in Jersey City, or you went to Manhattan for something. Mm-hmm. But we were a self-sustaining community, and we really relied on each other. It was a mix and just a melting pot of folks. I think that's because, Ralph, you know, when people came over from different countries, you know, in the 30s, and they came over through Ellis Island, they stayed in Jersey City, the New York and the Hudson County area. So that contributed to a lot of Bayonne. So I had a big culturally diverse community, German, Polish, Italian, Irish, you know, So it was a mix of strong people.
I knew Cubans there.
A lot of Cubans. Yeah. As time went on, a lot of Cuban migrants came in. And they, I think a lot of Jersey City up on Bergenline Avenue, there was a lot.
Yeah.
We had them mixed in with ours. So it just added to the culture. And I think, honestly, Ralph, it's what contributed to me being able to infiltrate so many different organizations, because I was so used to growing up with the different cultures.
Yeah.
You know, my dad was a football coach. He was not only my father, but he's a father to so many kids that didn't have dads.
Yeah.
You know, in low income housing. So, you know, we relied. My father taught me how to look out for other people. You know, he was hard on me, as I describe in a book.
Yeah.
He had a loving heart.
Sounds a lot like my father.
Yeah. Very strong. Very strong. Yeah. He expected everything out of me. He was a little bit lenient on others. You know, he would bend the rules, or, you know, give him a little bit of leeway. With me and my brothers, he didn't give us any leeway. And I appreciate that to this day. So.
And he was a vet, Vietnam vet.
He was a Vietnam vet. Yeah. He served. They lived over in Germany in the younger years. And, you know, him and my mom were born into low-income housing and fought their way out and fought to give us a better life. Yeah, I'm truly grateful to have the family, man.
Yeah, yeah. And he was a police officer.
He was, yeah. I'm third-generation police. You know, and he was a good cop. You know, it comes with this trauma. I talk about that a lot now. I share with first responders. My dad was, you know, back then you didn't understand trauma. So he was a, he was a hardened cop. He was a hardened, he didn't have a father figure for the most part when he was growing up. So, you know, a lot of my upbringing was hard as a cop would raise any kid's cop, any cop's kid, you know. He was hard on us. He was hard on school. He was to the point, you know. Didn't help when he came home with autopsy photos when I was younger. But, you know, he wanted to keep us out in the neighborhood. He wanted to keep us safe. I guess that was community policing back then, you know. But, hey, you know.
You were kind of a rebel, huh?
I was a rebel, yeah. I was the black sheep of the family. I wasn't the best student. You know, I caused my parents a lot of heartache and a lot of headaches. You know, I was getting in trouble, I think, in parochial school and Catholic school. I think I got my first detention in kindergarten or first grade, I think it was. And from there, it was just downhill, you know.
So. Talk about your graduation from high, because you said you weren't a great student.
Yeah.
And you had kind of this unique graduation from high school.
I did.
Which
I
is,
did.
Today, people would be scandalized by something like that. But in those days, things like that happened.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the Jersey way, right? you know, I don't know if it still goes on to this day. I wouldn't doubt it in some way, shape, or form. So, yeah, I mean, again, summer school every year. Okay. Yeah. And just to show you, I was a smart kid. Okay. It's just that I didn't apply myself.
Clearly. Yeah.
I was not an educated kid. I fought back. If there was authority in my life, I fought it. Whether it was in church, whether it was in school, whether it was anywhere, I fought authority because of my relationship with my dad.
Yeah.
So as time went on, every year with summer school, you know, I was the bane of the existence because we couldn't go on vacations because this knucklehead had to go to school.
Yeah.
I even almost got left back in catechism, which is like CCD. You know, who does that?
I got kicked out.
Okay. So
asking too many questions.
So yeah, as high school came, you know, I learned to scam the system. You know, part of my undercover trait, I would always bargain. I was in auto mechanics. I would bargain with my teachers. Listen, you give me an A, you give me a B. I'm not even asking for an A or B. You give me a minimum passing grade and I'll fix your car for nothing, you know? So I was a hustler. And then came the time when I was due to graduate. A very good friend of mine in high school and myself, but we weren't going to walk the stage. We weren't going to graduate until my history teacher came up to us and said, look, you know, you two clowns. And he knew my dad. He went to school with my dad and my mom. And he said, look, you two knuckleheads, you know, you're not going to graduate. And, but I got to be honest, because morons like you, you know, I have a tiki bar in my backyard in Brick Township down the shore. And what I do is because of idiots like you, I stock my bar. So here's what's going to happen. You know, I'm the saving grace for you two idiots. So you're going to buy me a bottle of Johnny Walker Blue and a bottle of Johnny Walker Black. You're going to gift wrap it and you're going to put it here in my desk drawer between classes when I'm not here. The door's going to be open. And I had to go home and tell my mom. Now, my mom, you can only imagine. My mom is a strong Catholic woman. You know, couldn't tell a lie if
you would have had a heart attack.
Oh, yeah. you couldn't get her to lie.
Yeah.
But I had to go and I had to basically tell her, listen, I got to do this. You know, your buddy is the buddy that you grew up and went to high school with. He's choking me and he's squeezing me. So I got, so she was the one because the more expensive bottles were behind the counter. So I couldn't go into
Johnny Walker Blue, man.
Yeah. I couldn't go in there and buy it. So, so, you know, she kind of broke down. She's like, all right, I'll go get it, you know, gift wrap it. And there you go. And I graduated.
Yeah.
But as I write in a book, I had my revenge years later. I was thankful for it, but I had my pound of flesh, you know. He was bartending one night years later, and I caught him without a liquor license, and I did a bar check, and I banged him out with a bunch of summonses. So, you know, karma's a bitch.
Yeah, it sure is.
So
he must have been surprised to see you.
He was definitely surprised. I write a great story in a book, and it's, you know, exactly what happened. He wrote these tickets, and he kept begging me. I don't understand. What's with all these tickets? You know, I know so-and-so. I'm connected to this guy. I know that guy. I know the chief.
Right.
And I just kept writing and writing. And you had to really screw up to get me to write a ticket.
Yeah.
And I kept banging him out. I even called for an extra book because there's only 10 summonses in a book. I had to call to the precinct to have him bring more. And he couldn't figure it out. So I said, you just don't get it. You just not.
He didn't remember you.
No, he didn't remember. Not in a million years does this guy ever think that I would amount to be a police officer, right?
Right.
I was dead or in jail by 25.
Yeah.
So, and I said to him, listen, it's not clicking yet, huh? Look down at the name tag. Take a look. Read the name tag. And it just, and it's the feeling of just the world caving in on him. And, he's like,
have fun in your tiki bar, buddy.
Yeah, there's no way out of this. No, there's no way of talking out of this. You got to take your punishment. So
that's right. That's right. So you graduate and then you end up as a telephone man.
I did. And that was by pure luck. Listen, I don't even believe in luck. I think it's divine intervention.
Sure it is.
Because I truly was at that point in my life. I was just turning 18. My friends had decided to get into some business that was not going to end well for us, any of us. And I don't even think a lot of them probably aren't with us today. So, I kind of backed away from that life, and I took the high road. I always thought I'd be a cop, but I didn't think I'd have it in me.
Really?
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. I even have my eighth grade summer school essay, the reasons why and what I wanted to do with my life. And I saved it to this day. I still have it.
No kidding.
I knew, but I didn't have faith in myself at the time, right?
You didn't see the path.
No, I didn't believe in it.
Yeah.
So I just said, I'll live hard and I'll die, I'll live fast, I'll die hard.
Yeah.
And that's the way I'm going to go. So, senior year, right after the bribe happened and right around that same time, New Jersey Bell came in and they gave like a job fair. So one of my buddies, his dad was a cop, and he says, listen, let's cut out of school for the rest of the day. We'll head on a train. We'll hit New York. We'll take this test. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, sign me up. Any chance to cut out of class, right? So I took the test real quick, mm-hmm. jumped on a train, hung out over in probably Washington Square Park at the time. Mm-hmm. And, that was it. 2 months later, they called me back and offered me a job.
Wow.
Turned out I passed. I was one of the highest passing grades.
Wow.
And they offered me a job. And when I got out, I graduated in June. And I think by July, I was in what they call plant school. And I was a telephone repair and installation guy. But again, I wanted to work in all those violent areas.
Yeah.
So sign me up,
Yeah. And you tell a funny story in the book about how you're working outside social clubs in the area, and the guys would come out and go.
Yeah. Dale, that one was Dale's Avenue. You can't forget it. It's like it was yesterday. You know, how many years? 35 years ago. It was Dale's Avenue. And I'm skinny, I'm as big as my pinky, skinny little twig. And, but again, I knew these guys. I knew how to swim amongst them and live amongst them.
Yeah, talk to them. Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't intimidate me. So here comes Jumbo. This guy looks like he's Jumbo. He's 400, 500 pounds, comes out, and he gets sent out to call me down a pole. And I'm looking down, and he says, come down here. Let me see your work orders. Get out of here.
Yeah.
Just come down here. We're not going anywhere. We're going to be here all day. So, they checked the work orders, like gangsters would do back then. Because we had, every time you climbed a pole, you would see the little wiretap boxes that the government put in, when they were listening to the phone. So you knew.
Yeah.
They're always like, listen, kid, we'll pay you a little bit extra cash. You let us know, if our phones are being tapped. Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'll let you know.
Yeah, I never did.
But there was a bunch of times like that.
That's crazy.
And the drug dealers. And again, it helped me assimilate, right? To acclimate to that environment.
Yeah.
When you're going in at nighttime into the Kerry Woods projects in Jersey City, dude, it was like walking into a horror movie,
Yeah.
You're talking gunshots are going off and, just the things that I saw on the job gave me so much empathy for people.
Yeah.
These poor little old lady that lived on the first floor of the apartment buildings, and she had to sleep in her bathtub.
Yeah.
Because the rounds would come through the wall. You don't know until you see how others live,
The Currys Woods Public Housing Project consisted of 7 12-story brick buildings with 712 units. During the 1980s, it became notorious for poverty, drugs, and crime, and became the setting of 2 well-known novels by author Richard Price, Clockers and Freedomland. Price had befriended a homicide investigator named Calvin E. Hart of the New Jersey Police Department, a guardian angel among people in the projects, and became the basis of the lead characters in both books. They were both made into movies. Clockers, starring Harvey Keitel and John Turturro, and directed by Spike Lee, came out in 1994. And Freedomland, directed by Joe Roth, and starring Samuel Jackson and Julianne Moore, was released in 2006. People have no idea.
You have no idea. But again, it provided me that empathy that I needed, what I saw growing up. And when it came time for me to ingratiate, whether it was white supremacists, whether it was Black Panthers, Russians, culturally, I can ingratiate myself to everybody.
Right. You
know? So that was a blessing.
Fantastic. Yeah. So then you make the transition to police, and how just took a couple of years, right?
Yeah. Into undercover work.
No, into the becoming a police officer.
Yeah, I think within a year, my old man called me up and told me they were giving a police job in New Jersey. And, you know, hey, listen, they're giving a statewide test or whatever it was. And yeah, sure, I'll give it a shot.
Yeah.
And again, I just went into it thinking, I didn't study that much for it. I took it and it was an aptitude test. And I passed, I think they were hiring 10 and they made it 11 spot for me. You know,
well, nice.
Jersey nepotism at its finest. You know, so I was blessed once again.
You show up to work on a motorcycle.
Yeah. Right?
So you still had that rebellious streak in you.
I did. And I promised the chief of police when he called me, he knew me since I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And when he offered me the job, he says, look, I'm going to make an 11 spot for you, but I got to know, you know, you changed your ways and you know, you're not that kid you used to be. And sure. You know, and I was a bit of a jerk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, look, you know, I'm making this spot and do you want this job? Yeah, sure. He says, well, you got to be more convincing than that.
Let's give it. Yeah, right.
So he made me promise, change the evil ways. And, you know, if you come on my department. So I did. And then 9 months later, when I got comfortable, I decided to show up on a motorcycle. You know, my police uniform pants. I had a white T-shirt on and a leather vest. And, you know, here I am.
Perfect.
Totally street illegal bike. Nothing on this thing was legal at all.
Yeah,
it was actually my uncle's bike I had borrowed. And it was a chopper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he came in, just luck would have it, as I'm pulling in on this thing under the precinct parking garage, it's just setting off car alarms and just, and he went up one side and down the other. He said, you swore to me, you swore. And I thought, that's it. You know, I hope the phone company's going to take me back because I'm going to get fired. And so then that was it. He called me in 3 weeks later and said, look, I got this small little job. If you want to do it, it's an undercover thing. And you know, I said, sure, I'll give it a chance. And it was a ground ball. And I got right into it. And then that was my calling. I figured out this is what I wanted to do. Narcotics and undercover work is what I wanted to do.
Yeah. You sort of fell into that right away. It was like a natural for you.
It was. Again, being in the street, developing informants as a patrol guy. My partner, Timmy, and I were real aggressive cops to the point where it was pursuits every night. You know, guys couldn't sleep on a midnight shift when they wanted to because the older Dukers, you know, the Vietnam guys, they wanted to sleep all night and not be bothered and hear these two idiots are causing foot chases and foot pursuits and car pursuits. And, you know, you're talking Newark at the height of the carjacking era. It was insane. Every night was running and gunning.
Yeah.
So literally. And so finally I got to the point where they're like, you know what? These guys are just better off in plain clothes. So give them a gold shield. And they put me in narcotics.
And you had plenty of action there.
Oh, God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's when it all started, you know?
Yeah.
Then I became, from that point, I was Frankenstein. You know, you fight, at times you're fighting for your life. Cubans and Colombians were the biggest targets for narcotics back then. You know, you're talking the later days of the Escobar days and the Cali cartels and Medellin cartels. And then the Cuban Maralitos that came in from Castro sent all those prisoners.
Yeah.
They kind of migrated to that Jersey City area.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There was a Cuban community there. So that makes sense. Yeah.
Huge. And the people that were there. The community was a great community. Problem was, when you mix in this bad element, and again, the close proximity, you hit it right on the head, the close proximity to Manhattan and Queens and Bronx, and just for trafficking purposes out of Miami, it was just, you know, it was a hub.
Yeah.
So we saw, you know, just families being slaughtered over 10 kilos of cocaine back then.
God.
You know, just horrible. Literally would slaughter an entire family just to rob them.
Wow.
You know, so yeah, so it was a lot of trauma and a lot of action, fighting for your life and just doing crazy stuff. It was crazy. It was insane.
Just out of control.
No, with that. And then the crack, you know, the crack epidemic was
God.
You know, that was my peak of my narcotics.
Yeah.
But even before I made it into narcotics on a night shift is really I wanted to be. They gave me a gold shield and they put me in vice.
Mm-hmm.
So vice consisted of prostitution, a little bit of gambling and organized crime. So during the day, you weren't really chasing bad guys and gangbangers and stuff and cartels. You were chasing a 70-year-old bookmaker. You know, back in the day, it was the guys running the numbers. You know,
yeah,
it was the three and the four numbers, the lottos, and you know, and the bookmaking and the gambling and sports book. So I was kind of pissed. I was like, no, hold on, man. I'm 20 something years old. I don't want to chase Uncle Louie that's, you know, running on a corner and this guy over here. Yeah. You know, here I am wrestling with 70 year old men who were in their walkers, you know, and but they wanted their bookies. So but from that, it was great because we were hitting the old wire rooms mm-hmm. over New York. Mm-hmm. You know, the wire rooms would be long before you had the internet and gambling. You would call the 800 number on a Sunday and you put your bets in.
Yeah.
So we were working with OCCB over there in New York, the organized crime bureau, and just hitting doors with those. You know, it was great, but again, it, looking back, somebody was guiding me along, because it all contributed to what I did in my culmination of my undercover work.
Yeah, well, Giovanni, it's so interesting how you sort of moved from undercover police to DEA to FBI.
Yeah.
Can you describe that?
Yeah. So, you know, if you imagine, I was, as a young undercover, once they gave me my gold shield and I was able to work narcotics, I started to grow my beard out, my hair, and I kind of gravitated to what I knew with my uncles. I was always attracted to the outlaw motorcycle life mm-hmm. because my uncles were in that, and or they were around it a lot. And I was exposed to it as well.
And they were big into drugs, those guys.
Yeah, they were big into drugs. Yeah.
Yeah.
But my uncles were respected guys. They weren't mm-hmm. flying any colors or patches or for anybody, but they had very strong connections to strong, very predominant clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had exposure to that. So that's kind of what I gravitated to. Grew my hair out, put all the earrings in my ear, and just grew my hair down on my ass. And I looked like a fiend. I looked like a drug fiend. I looked like an addict, you know, being so thin. And I was able to go anywhere. So they really started to use me. One of the first cases I did was an outlaw case connected to a major outlaw group in the New York area. And a couple of guys were low-hanging fruit and associates. So the ultimate goal was to get in with that group.
Yeah.
That was about a nine-month thing. But, you know, you didn't hear that back then. Back then it was, you never left your area of responsibility. You kind of stayed in your jurisdiction.
Right.
But the DEA wanted to use me, and they used me on that case along with the local agencies and state agencies. And then before you know it, like any good prostitute, you know, when you're making money for the government, the government's your pimp and you're just another, right. another prostitute. So
we found a good one here.
Yeah. Man. And they just pimp you out. Right.
Yeah.
And I didn't care. You could pimp me out to anybody because it was adrenaline was my addiction. Right.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to do. And whatever it took, I was there. So DEA started using me a lot until they decided to bring me on a task force full time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I joined a DEA task force out of Newark, and then that allowed me just to work cartels and cases all over the world, coming in, you know, from into the States, and all good undercover stuff.
Yeah.
And put myself into some dangerous situations and almost got myself killed a couple of times by my own doing because I didn't have the proper training. All I knew was what I grew up as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. In those days, they just threw you out there. Right now there's all kinds of training and different situations that you're put in and mm-hmm. so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's liability, right? Like, you know, the departments realize how much liability they have. Back then, it was, if you had an asset, if you were female and you had certain assets and certain looks, you could be a Colombian female.
Yeah.
With no experience in the street. You just happen to be a very beautiful Colombian with a lot, you know, who has physical assets and attributes to her.
Mm-hmm.
And they would make you a money drop girl. Like they give you $500,000 in cash and you'd start moving money around for these guys. And you know, they just put us, but again, it's because we wanted to do it too.
Yeah.
We weren't forced to do it.
Right.
We just, you know, and we did some wild and crazy stuff.
Interesting work. Yeah.
Yeah. We did some stuff, man, that just, you know, you look back and you go, man, I'm lucky to still be here. You know, I've been sewn back together. You know, I've
my
knees, my shoulders, my eye was sewn back on. I've been stuck and stabbed. And, you know, so yeah, we've been through it, you know, but
yeah. And it's in this period that you meet your wife, right?
I was married. And when I was with the DEA, I was married to my first wife. And yeah, we had a couple of kids and things got out of hand because the undercover life really gets to you.
That's a tough life. Yeah.
It was a tough life, right? You know, I was not an easy individual to live with, but I had two kids and living that life was great. And then I put myself in a couple of situations that almost got myself killed. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take a step back. I'm going to shave.
Yeah.
Cut off all my hair. I went through a bad marriage and I had gotten divorced. And then I met my wife, my second wife. I met her on the job, if that's you're referring to her.
Yeah.
So she was in law enforcement as well. At the time we were investigating a Mexican cartel at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we were working a case and, you know, here I was in the street and doing my thing with my partner and just, you know, I needed a radio or something. And then she had brought it out to me and we met. And I swore I would never date a cop, let alone marry one.
Yeah.
Here we are all these years later with our children of our own.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was pretty amazing.
And then right after you meet her, right? Her 9/11 happens.
Yeah. Shortly after 9/11 happened. And that was a terror in itself. You know,
yeah.
I was living when we were, you know, just dating and, you know, moving forward with our relationship. I was living back in Bayonne. I went back to my roots.
Okay.
And that morning I was in Bayonne, you know, I was getting a haircut.
And you're right there.
I was literally, you could throw a rock, which felt like you could throw a rock and hit, you know, I grew up there.
Yeah.
So here I am. I got up early that morning. I went down the street, walked down a block to my barber who's been cutting my hair since, you know, 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And I walk in, you know, and it's gotta be 7:30 in the morning when I walk in. And he's cutting my hair, turned the TV on, and boom, there you are. You know, first, everything was just kicking off that morning.
But your wife was, the stakes were really high for her because her dad was involved.
Yeah, her dad was a law enforcement also at the time. He was still active in the department and responding there. And me, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, listen, I'm DEA at the time. So right away, I told her when she started to call me. First call I got was from my father called me. And my father never panicked. He was where are you? Where are you? Where he was so concerned for me because I guess he knew, you know, being a government mm-hmm. and that access that I had, I'd be there if I could right away.
Yeah.
So as I drove to my office in Newark, and I'll never forget, as I'm pulling in, the first tower had collapsed. And you know, a series of events. And then she started to call me saying, listen, I can't get a hold of my father. And I said, okay, relax. Just, you know.
Yeah.
I'll get a hold of him. He's going to be at a command center. So, you know.
Yeah, it was impossible to get hold of anybody. Yeah,
no, it was. We lost communications for a while.
Yeah.
But again, the hard lines are working, right? And, you know, and I just kept assuring her. She kept calling back at my desk. And I was like, look, relax. Like, your dad's not in those buildings. You don't know my father. You don't know, you know, so you don't understand. I know he's in those buildings. She knew in her heart of hearts he was in there.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, the rest unfolded the next couple of days. Just, you know. We wound up there that morning and, you know, she and I picked her up as I describe in the book.
Yeah.
You know, this is so important because I needed people to understand her story.
Sure.
And my story together with her.
Sure. But
I had already put her through so much. She had already experienced so much from the job.
Yeah.
Being a cop's kid and then 9/11. And then here I am at the end, you know, all the guilt that I carried for putting her through when she finally put her life back together. And to this day, it's not whole, but 22 years later and. You know, every time I feel for these families because every time they find something or you know, they just identified right before the anniversary, they identified two more people and
you know,
it just kicks all that bad juju up.
What Giovanni doesn't say, but is stated in his book, is that his wife's father died when the Twin Towers went down. He was a hero. And like other victims of that terrorist attack, not a trace of his body was ever found. Giovanni was dating his future wife at the time and never left her side. Later, they were married and started a family. That tragedy cemented them together, two law enforcement officers, both of whom's fathers had been in law enforcement, and both who understood the risks and the emotional toll law enforcement work can take. As Giovanni writes poignantly in his book, and I quote, "For my wife, the wounds inflicted by 9/11 may never heal." I went down there like a couple days later and there was nothing. I mean, it was dust.
Yeah.
There were just paper and piles of dust.
That's all. I compare it to being in a snowstorm.
Yeah.
We had been there that morning. Yeah. As if you had a... And it was a 6-foot snowstorm that fell because you couldn't hear. We drove west side because, again, we were in emergency vehicles and we had escorts in and out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were there. I mean, you came off and you drove towards Battery Park. It was an emotional roller coaster. You had the people every day lined up cheering for every first responder that came in and went out.
Yeah.
But you could barely hear them over the sound of, like you described, the dust and just the settling debris. It was very eerie, very eerie. The sights, sounds, the smells.
Yeah, the smell, it was that burned smell.
Yeah.
Let's get into the Charlie Stango case, because that's the heart of the book.
Right.
And just an amazing story. How did that get started?
Yeah, I was working a bunch of different undercover stuff. So now I'm with the FBI for a number of years. Yeah. I had been trained by the FBI. I received all the proper training.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, my career was on steroids. My undercover, my trade craft was now on steroids, right?
Yeah.
Because everything I learned, I mean, the Bureau taught me so much, but I would go down rabbit holes. I practiced mindfulness, my breathing, controlling my breath, and just, you know, mastering that, because the things that I had done before I met Charlie Stango and infiltrated the mob were probably more violent episodes, like being murder for hires that I did.
And you're dealing with really sketchy guys who on drugs.
Yeah, I would do a meeting with the guy. You know, I did some cartel guys one night, just maybe a year before that case started, the Charlie case. And they left a meeting one night and gunned the guy down. And we knew he gunned a guy down in New York, and then had to have a meeting with him the next 2 days later, 3 days later. You know, different groups, the Russians. And, you know, so while I was doing foreign counterintelligence stuff as well, mm-hmm. so I wasn't doing just criminal stuff. I had my feet and my hands in everything. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, the reason why it came to be was a lot of times guys would lean on people like me, street cops, for bona fides. There's nothing that shock and awes us.
Yeah.
So you would call me in and you would say, hey, gee, and that's what happened. One night I had an undercover call me and he said, look, I got some guys. There's some shooters, there's some heavy hitters, you know, some street guys. They're coming down to drop some dope off to me down Atlantic City. You want to come down and have dinner?
Yeah.
So all I heard was dinner, you know. You know, dinner at a 5-star restaurant, count me
in. Yeah, hey. You know what I mean? Yeah, I'm good.
And my Uncle Sam's footing the bill, count me in.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had gone to the meeting and I said, you know, I told my wife, listen, I'm going to run down to AC. I won't be long. She knew I was full of crap, you know.
Yeah.
And she knows. She did undercover work herself. And she said, no, no, this is going to, it's a ground ball. I'll be back in no time.
Yeah.
So by the time these guys showed up, my wife's threatening voice in my head saying, if you're not back by morning, you know. So the hours dragged on and these guys showed up and they were some, you know, street kids, some capable kids, as we call them.
Yeah.
And the one guy happened to be related to Charlie Stango, and they created this whole persona in their head about us.
Yeah.
Mostly about me, because the attitude that I had and the way I did it and I describe it, I was real standoffish, but business cold, like a gangster, like a true gangster would be.
Yeah, which that's the kind of person they take seriously.
Yeah, yeah, just from my neighborhood, right? You know,
yeah,
I'm not,
yeah,
listen,
yeah.
You know, not going to hurt you. Why would I hurt you? I love you.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. Wink, wink, you know? So he went back to the neighborhood up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, which, to set it for your folks listening, or the scene of the Sopranos. So this family is the DiCavalcante family. Everything you watch in the Sopranos, the neighborhood, the pork store, the houses, everything, the way they live, it was actually filmed in that old neighborhood also.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very familiar with the DiCavalcante family, having done a lot of surveillance and funerals and John Gotti's funeral and all this, you know, the connections that they had to all these people over the years. I had, you know, I had great intel. So I knew who the players were.
Yeah,
I knew who the cast of characters were. So I showed up for this job. This kid goes back and he tells everybody after we get the dope off him, he says, yeah, I met these guys last night. They must be Bruno Scarfo guys. They were down in Philly. I went down to AC. And he created this whole illusion for himself and talked us up.
Right.
Who cares? No big deal. The government, we looked at it as, no worries. Let him think who we are. If he thinks we're gangsters, it'll keep us safe.
That's right.
Not knowing it would be the next 3 years of my life. So as it went on, and I met more guys and more guys in that family, the guy Jimmy I met in Atlantic City, he kind of passed me off to a guy, Luigi. Luigi was a good guy, and then he kind of just wanted to do business with me, but the government's looking for the best target.
Yeah.
Jimmy's looking to make money. Luigi's looking to make money. So they really started to compete against each other for my business.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of swag. I had a lot of hijack stuff. You know, shoes, cigarettes were really big in the street for me. So I was earning money in the street.
So this is all stuff that the FBI just seizes some of it was from stuff other that, drug busts and stuff.
Yeah. Some of it was other cases I had. I had done a really big case out of China just before this case. So I literally had a warehouse full of stuff. You know,
wow.
And, you know, all the stuff from Canal Street. I mean, good quality knockoff stuff. And then I had cigarettes. But my cigarettes weren't knockoffs. My cigarettes were legit.
Mm-hmm.
So in the street, that's pure gold.
Yeah, I think people don't understand how valuable cigarettes are.
Oh, yeah.
Even in international terrorism, it's a huge thing.
Huge. Yeah. It put me into so many groups, criminal groups, and like you said, terror groups. You know, even political groups, like, you know, politicians, they're even making money out of it. They can. So here I had these things, and Luigi and Jimmy were kind of, you know, fighting over who was going to be my best friend.
Yeah.
And they would trump each other. You know, Louis would say, hey, listen, Jimmy's a clown. You should be with me. Make money with me. What are you doing with that kid? He's going to get you in trouble. He runs around with a bunch of shooters. And then so Jimmy turns around and says, hey, listen, G, come with me. My uncle's Charlie Stengel. He's a captain.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what the hell? What does that mean? So I didn't come in knowing I knew how the mafia works, right? I had done Italian mafia work before.
Right.
But I came into this playing stupid.
Yeah.
I came into this as a guy. I'm well polished and I'm well dressed, but I used to be a biker. But now I realize I don't want to sleep in double wide trailers and sleep on the ground under my motorcycle. So now I'm a more polished criminal. That's how I portrayed myself.
One thing that a lot of people don't appreciate, and I thought the Sopranos did this really well, is how insular these groups are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Culturally insular.
Yeah.
Right. And so much of it is little things, behavior. And you had all that. And also you knew how to play this the role of the guy who kind of hangs back, the serious guy who hangs back.
You got to know when to say no, right?
Yeah.
Cops are desperate, right?
Yeah.
And I don't want to give a tutorial on undercover work. I'm not giving away tradecraft, but anybody will tell you this.
I'm just talking about the psychological, behavioral aspect of it.
Sure. And what put me into this position, Ralph, was when I showed up for that dinner down in Atlantic City, this kid showed up with the drugs on him.
Yeah.
Okay. So imagine this kid had half a kilo in his crotch.
Yeah.
Now, when I hear that, I'm not the main undercover, but my undercover friend, you have to know how to read each other.
Yeah.
So when he says, where do you want to do this? And my buddy goes, I don't know. Gee, what do you think? Gio, where do you want to do this? And I turn around and go, do what?
Yeah.
And he goes, well, you know, this kid's got some stuff in me, brought it down. I don't know what that is. I'm not here for that. I'm here to eat dinner. That's what you're talking about, Ralph.
Right, right.
That's the thing a real criminal, a real bad guy, a real gangster would do.
Right.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not here. I mean, I'm here to eat my galamon. I'm here to eat my pasta, and I'm here for nice company and a nice conversation. I'm going home. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right.
So when this kid turns around and says, well, I have it on me, my reaction was, you have what? You don't even answer me. You have something on you. I don't know you. I never met you. Do me a favor. Yeah. Get out of here. Get away from my table. And then again, the push and pull, right? My buddy
said,
Gio, calm down. That's what you're talking about. And a real guy would do
right,
that.
Exactly.
So because I did that, that's why. But now the insular with the DiCavalcantes, that's a different thing, right?
Yeah.
Because every crime family, every Borgata, as they call them, is insulary, right?
Yeah.
But the DiCavs are different. There's a chapter or the main hub in New York, but this one out of Elizabeth, New Jersey, they all live in the same small little neighborhood.
Borgata, translated from Italian, means township or village. It's the basic structural unit of mafia society. Each borgata or village or family has an established hierarchy with a body of members or soldiers and associates.
It's very Soprano-esque where everybody knows everybody. These guys would kill somebody in the neighborhood. Years ago in the 80s, I know they gunned the guy down or killed the guy in the street. And, you know, little Nona sitting on a porch and everybody watched this happen. Nobody even said anything.
Right.
So this is the organization you're going into.
Yeah.
So, and you're an outsider.
Yeah.
You didn't grow up in this neighborhood.
Yeah.
They don't know you. So now you've got to completely be on your game.
Yeah.
So, and they looked at me. They looked at me sideways.
I'm sure. Well, especially, Louis the dog.
Louis the dog did. Yeah. Luigi did.
Yeah.
And even when I was making money with him, I dropped some stuff off at his club. Unbeknownst to me, they got word that the police, that law enforcement were looking at them. We didn't know what level.
Yeah.
We didn't know whether it was local, state, or the government, right? That was looking at the feds.
Yeah.
But I dropped stuff off to him one day with an associate of mine. I'm sitting in his club and he's making me espresso and he says, hey, you know, just to let you know, you're new around here.
Mm-hmm.
And just to let you know, we got wind. We're being looked at. The bulls, the cops, the bulls are looking at us.
Yeah.
And we know it for a fact. So I want you to know, like, you know, you're new around here. So I'm just saying, what are you saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you saying?
What are you saying?
It got tense.
Yeah.
And again, you don't want to get physical, but so what are you saying? I'm not understanding you. I hope you're not saying what. And then what happened was he kind of panicked in a minute and he kind of like, no, I'm not saying you. I hope you're not saying me.
Right.
You know, because if you have a problem with me, I'll just leave and I'll never come back here.
Right.
You know, I'm here to make money.
Yeah.
But because I did that, he checked the box and he says, well, I'm just saying, you know, we got eyes and ears out there with law enforcement. They told us we're looking at it.
Yeah.
So I go back and I tell my house, I tell the feds, hey, listen, they got word that there's a leak.
Yeah.
And we looked into it and we weren't sure what level. We thought it was even coming at our level.
Yeah.
So at that point, when that came out, this FBI, imagine an FBI case having to be red flagged and closed internally in the FBI.
Yeah.
But they red flagged it. Nobody had access to this case from that point forward because we didn't know. We didn't know where the leak was coming from.
Yeah.
We found out later in the book, I described where the leak came from.
Yeah.
But yeah, so here I am. Now I'm being told I'm infiltrating the mob in my backyard.
Yeah.
3 miles from where I grew up, basically, as the bird flies.
And close to where you're still living with your
close
family.
Close to where I'm still living in Jersey, right?
Yeah.
And I got all these things happening. And at what point do I go, this is not for me? But my adrenaline just got the better of me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Louis was smart. Louis even said to me late in the case, he's like, you walk like us, you talk like us, but where do you come from? Like, and it all came out, you know, it came.
Well, that seemed to be the sticking point was like, what's your background, right? Like, where did you come from? You just showed up.
Yeah. He asked me in the beginning, first time I ever got introduced to him. And I met him and I had a coffee with him in a Starbucks and we sat and had an espresso. And he says, so where are you from? I said, well, I'm from New York by way of Atlantic City. And, you know, no. Where are your people from? Where are you from? Oh,
yeah.
Here's where I'm from. I'm from here. You know, and he goes, oh my God, I'm Sicilian. We could be related.
Yeah.
So we had that conversation. He goes, you know, so he checked the box and asked me what my culture was, who my family was.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't hesitate, because if he looked into me, it all matched up. You know, I knew who I was.
Yeah.
I had been in prison, you know, I had a criminal history and, you know, if they ever ran me, God forbid, and their leaks ran, and they eventually did, they ran me and saw that I had done prison time and that I had been arrested for violent crimes and attempted murder and all this stuff.
Which is all the backstopping.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you got to be careful with your backstopping because you can't just do, again, I'm not giving away trade crap, but you can't, if you've never been inside a prison, you know, you can't talk about prison. You can't say, I've done time.
Right.
You can't even be a cop that says, oh, yeah, I used to drop guys off when I dropped them off in prison. I would bring them in and drop them off in the green room.
Yeah.
You have to know. And again, I know because I had family or I had friends that were in prison and I would go and, you know, I knew the inner workings. I knew.
Right.
My language, everything about me changed for decades. I didn't talk like a cop. I didn't walk like a cop. I didn't wear cop clothes. I didn't.
Yeah.
When I referred, if I got pulled over for speeding, I never said, hey, brother. You know, here's my badge. Don't give me a ticket. I would call him boss. Hey, boss.
Yeah.
That's what an inmate, you know, that's what a convict calls a corrections guy.
Right. You had to know guys in prison.
You had to know guys.
They're going to want to know, like, well, who did you know? Who were you in with?
Yeah. And I'll be honest, Rob, I don't think I've ever talked about this before, ever. And I was so paranoid that they would see me for who I was and I would fail a test. We had good informants. We had really high level informants in our squads. And we had an informant and I asked him to bring me around serious guys.
Yeah.
And not for the purpose of investigation. I wanted to be vetted.
Yeah.
I wanted to see if I could swim in shark invested waters with great whites, right?
Yeah.
With the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
So I was around guys. And as this case was going down to La Cosa Nostra, it was going down a mob case. I wanted to make sure. So I had a very high level informant. Just bring me around, guys. Go get lunch, go get dinner. They asked me who I was, what I did.
Yeah.
And I would just kind of test the waters and make sure I'm okay with this.
Interesting.
Before I even went into the family.
Yeah.
I put that much into it.
Wow.
But even when I wasn't operational, everywhere I'd go, when I was off duty, I'd go to Jersey City and there's certain places I walked in. You'd go into a pizzeria and a restaurant and you would sit, you would order your food. Well, everybody thought I was a bad guy.
Yeah.
They never challenged me. I'd say, hey, it's, you know, I'm going to go sit in the back.
Yeah.
No, the lights are off. You want the music on? No, leave the lights off. I'm going to go sit in the back. I'd sit in a dark room.
Yeah.
And I'd start having meetings back there. And anytime I brought targets in, like terrorist targets or politicians, political corruption cases, imagine I painted that picture. So I was living that life 24/7, even when I wasn't operational.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
I go up to Nutley into the old Soprano neighborhoods. And I go to a pastry place and I get a pastry and a coffee and just sit. And people would actually think, you know, I was a hooked up guy and they're scratching their head, looking at me going, man, he must be from New York, you know?
Right, right.
And they just interact, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
fascinating.
And, yeah. So just to prepare for that role.
Yeah.
And Louis bit, they all bit,
yeah,
as you see.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of helped.
Mm-hmm.
But Louis was always a little suspicious.
Yeah.
And he wanted me and his crew as he was coming up in the family. He had been raised in that family.
Yeah.
as a little kid, he aspired to be a made guy one day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just happened to show up at the right time when all this was going on.
Yeah.
So Charlie Stango was getting out of prison after his murder bid. He served his time. He's on parole. And his nephew, Jimmy, had came to me. He wanted to trump Louie. And he says, look, you know, my uncle's Charlie Stango. So I'm like, I don't know who that is. Who's that? Well, you know, he's a captain. He's a captain. He's a cop. No. He's in the military. You say he's a captain. What's he a captain of? No. He's a capo. And again, I made him work for it. Right.
Yeah.
And I go, so what does that mean for me? That doesn't mean shit to me. No. You don't understand. If I could get my uncle to vouch for us, he's back in the street. He just got out from, you know, he did a murder bid and he pitched it to me.
Yeah.
I said, so what do we get out of it? He says, well, we can make money. If my uncle says we can sell this stuff in the street that you have, you know, all these boots and these shoes and these, all this cigarettes, we could sell them at union sites and construction sites.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, well, you know, whatever. I said, but I don't have a mouse in my pocket. You know, what's this wee shit? You know, like, I'll give you a cut, but you got to hustle.
Right.
So when Louis saw that, now Louis wanted in.
Yeah.
Now Louis all of a sudden wanted to do business with me. And then before you know it, Charlie Stango came calling.
Yeah.
You know, so from afar, these guys heard about Jimmy, heard about the business.
And, they all talk.
They all talk, man. Who's making money? How are they making money?
Right. There's this guy. He's got stuff. It's selling.
So Charlie was tight with the Gambinos. He had a Gambino associate reach out to me and vet me and meet me because, again, he was on parole.
Yeah.
So he kept it real. He was a very smart guy.
Yeah.
And he basically said, look, call up my nephew and this guy that Giovanni is doing business with and see what they're up to. So I had to go through that. I passed that test. Mm-hmm. I guess they went back and must have said, hey, the guy's okay.
Yeah.
Because next thing you know, I got called to lunch to meet Charlie Stango.
Yeah.
And I met him in a diner. And then he basically introduced himself and says, you know, listen, you seem like a decent kid. You're making money with my nephew. And, you know, so I just sat back and a conversation took place and he vouched for his nephew, not so much vouched for me, he vouched for his nephew and said, you see what I'm doing here? I'm going to let you continue doing what you're doing with the Gambinos.
Yeah.
Okay. But I'm going to watch. So if you screw this up, I'm going to let them do what they have to do to you, you know, but right now you understand what I'm doing. I'm vouching for you.
Yeah.
So when that vouch took place, I knew right then and there, oh shit, you know.
That's a big thing.
It's a big thing. So he said his goodbyes to me. Maybe I'll see you. Maybe I'll never talk to you again, but have a nice life. And a couple of months went by and next thing you know, Jimmy's giving me a burner phone saying, call my uncle. He wants to talk to you. So I got a prepaid phone, we'll call a burner phone. And I called him. By that time, he was out in Henderson, Nevada. He had his parole moved from Florida to Henderson, Nevada.
How do you do that?
Good question, man. That's a good PO, man. You must be a really good parolee. You know?
You must have some friends in the right places.
Yeah, you must have been following all the rules and, you know.
Yeah.
So here he was.
Yeah.
He moved out there. The day I met him in the diner was he was catching a flight that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I saw right away what an absolute gentleman, yet in the flip of a hat, like he could be a complete psychopath.
Right.
And I understood why they called him Charlie the Hat.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because the turn of the hat and he would just, you know, and then as I built a relationship with him for.
And what was he like physically? What was his age? And
man, at that time, he referred to it as 7 dimes and 2 pennies. He's 72, I'd say, you know, 7 dimes and 2 pennies.
Yeah.
I'm my own man. You know, I don't apologize for anything I do in this world. You understand?
Yeah.
And he'd always say, you understand? And and you could see like he, you know, okay. No, you don't understand nothing. You know, you had this crazy balance, you know?
Yeah.
You know? And when you said, I get it. No, you don't get it. I just told you, I get it, y'all. Like, you know, a very strong man, very committed.
Yeah.
Omerta is everything to him. He lives the life and committed to it.
And he's, 72, he's, he wasn't, and came out of jail. He wasn't looking to kick back.
No, he wasn't. No way. He's a gangster's gangster. He'll tell you that himself. Gangster's gangster.
Yeah. So he gets right back into it.
It's what he knows. He killed a guy in 1982 and got caught. And then one of the guys he did the hit with flipped on him. He even tried to kill that guy while he's on trial, you know, so he put, you know, and then he went on a run for a long time and then they caught him and he's a gangster's gangster. He knows.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So when I met him, he had a lifetime of murder and mayhem in him.
Yeah.
So, he saw something in me and I saw something in him. You know, it took a while to connect.
Yeah.
But once it connected, It was, but everything was going great. And then he had a nightmare one night. He had a bad dream.
Yeah. Something was, one of the wires was a little bit crossed or something. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a little fucked, as he,
Yeah.
So, yeah, he'd tell you, like, you know, so one night,
yeah,
I'm home. I'm home. And I was in my apartment in New York and just kind of chilling out, and everything was going great and everything seemed to be moving ahead in the right direction. And I had all these balls in the air. I had Louis was going well. Jimmy was going well. Jimmy was getting in trouble on the side. He got caught with a bunch of dope and a handgun, and he was going to prison, and everybody thought he might have been ratting because he came back in the street too quick. So I had all these crazy stuff going on, but then next thing you know, out of nowhere, he calls me up and says, you know, left me this crazy message. Listen, Charlie, whatever you and my nephew are doing, if it's illegal, I want nothing to do with it. And do yourself a favor, kid. Don't set my nephew up either. Okay? Do yourself a favor. Don't call me back.
Wow.
Now I speak mafia clearly.
Yeah,
don't
yeah.
call me back. Do yourself a favor.
Yeah.
You can interpret that.
Yeah, sure.
Loud and clear. So that was it. They hit the button. FBI says, we're done.
Yeah.
Case over. This guy's a murderer, mayhem type guy. We can't trust him.
Yeah.
But here I was, my addiction.
Yeah.
My adrenaline. I was like, well, hold on. Let's think about this. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
So we fought internally all the way down to the Hoover building.
Wow.
My supervisor, Anthony Zamponi, and myself, we thought we could figure out a way to mitigate it. If we can't, then we just dump Charlie
and
move on to the gambit. By this time, Charlie had put me into 4 to 5 major families.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, long story
short.
So
you were in.
I was in. Yeah. I was a messenger for him. And, you know, I started delivering messages. And he'd give me little tasks like, hey, some of them shirts you have, some of them cigarettes you have, go drop it off to a guy with the Columbos and go to Manhattan and do this. See a guy when you're out here, anything you need in Vegas, you know. So I was making trips out to Vegas, and then all of a sudden he left that message and it was done.
Hmm.
So we went cold for a while, maybe a month or so we went cold. But I asked the Bureau, let's just keep it moving. Let's just stay with the other families and let's see what Charlie does.
Mm-hmm.
So again, through the form, money drives the train, right?
The greed.
Right. So Charlie kept asking around. So you're still doing things with that kid, huh? You're still working with that kid, Giovanni? Yeah. Things are going great. I don't know what the conversations were, but to that, you know, Charlie shared with me later. And then finally he realized, well, wait a minute, I'm missing out on a lot of money here.
Yeah.
So he calls me up, left me a message, left me 2 messages, left me 5 messages, and I'm ignoring him. So, and they guess that he's getting madder and madder and, you know, call me the F back. Jesus Christ. Now he's not even leaving messages. He's talking to himself like a sociopath, like a psychopath. I can't believe this kid doesn't call me back. Call me the F back.
Yeah.
So finally I pick up the phone, it rings, and I play along, and we had a conversation, and he goes, look, come out to Vegas and see me, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, the Bureau's not going to let me do that.
Yeah.
But we mitigated it and we figured it out, and I went out there and did it. And then from that point on, he basically apologized. He told me, look, I had a dream. I had a bad dream that night when I left that message. You know, I woke up and I saw, you know, the fan going above me in the bed.
Yeah.
And there was a guy hanging off the fan, and there was wires, and you were one of the guys, and there were 2 guys connected with wires, and they were hanging above me and going around. He says, and I went through this whole thing. That's your gut telling me I'm no good. He says, so I grabbed the phone, I left that message for you. And then he would work himself into an anger.
Yeah.
Because he said, listen, I don't apologize for anything I do in this life, you know.
Yeah.
You understand me? Yeah, no, you don't. I don't, you know, and then, but from the bottom of my heart, I apologize, you know. So let's move forward, let's make some money.
Yeah.
So from that point going on, it just became a father and son relationship. You know, I had to earn my way in. It took a long time.
Yeah.
But he tasked me, and I represented him, and he would get feedback from whoever he sent me to a meeting. He would follow up.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, he put me in with some people that were having some problems with payroll in a company, and he put me with them, and you know, representing him. Then he started, hey, listen, you know, you're driving from Jersey, from New York to Atlantic City. That's too long of a ride for you. You got to find an office.
Yeah,
oh, I don't have the money to pay for an office. Well, I'll put you somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So next thing you know, he puts me in a place that he's connected to a guy who wound up being in my crew. He wound up being under me eventually. And he put me with this guy's company. And basically, it was like that scene in The Sopranos where they're all sitting in the office and that kind of setting. And then every day. And he liked what he was hearing to the point where, you know, he was checking on me. He came out to Jersey, saw what I was doing, introduced me to some old school guys.
Yeah, showed you around. Yeah, yeah.
He showed me off. Probably
showed you around.
He showed me off is what he did.
Yeah, that's right.
And he let it be known, I'm back.
Yeah.
And it wasn't about me.
Yeah.
I'm back.
Yeah.
I'm back. And this is my vessel. This kid is going to be my vessel.
Yeah.
So before you knew it, you know, he's saying, look, you're steering the ship. And I go, no, no, no. You're the skipper.
Yeah.
You're my skipper. I'm not steering the ship. You
right.
tell me. So conversations like that would, you know, again, for me, it's evidence purposes, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say, you're my skipper.
Yeah.
You're the guy that tells me I don't go anywhere. No, no, just keep doing what you're doing. It's good, good, good. You're earning good money. You know, you should earn good money. You deserve it.
Yeah.
And then it became, you know what? You know, maybe once in a while, throw me some money, pay my cell phone bill. I can make a car payment. I can give it to the old lady. She can go play some Keno. And that's how the kickup started.
Mm-hmm.
And before you know it, the kickup is going.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started kicking up to him, you know, it was I'd send a Christmas card or I'd send a birthday card, and that's how I sent the money.
Yeah.
And I'd send in a check in his wife's name.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's happy to get the money.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm sending him a good chunk of change, his kick up. Then I'm like, this is stupid. You know, I got to come out with cash. I can't be doing this with checks.
Right.
So we came up with the idea. I just kept going out to Vegas, making more trips out. And so as I started with him, Louis comes back around.
Yeah. And also he starts suggesting, like, you're part of my group, like things could go well for you. So in other words, you'll be a made, you keep on this track, you're going to be a made man.
Well, that was later when he explained to me I could be made, but
okay.
The way what you're saying is he did have a conversation. He said to me, look, from this point going forward, when I proved myself to him and I did represent him, it wasn't representing him anymore.
Yeah.
He said to me, I made a tape one time and it said, listen, you now represent the DiCavalcantes. So anywhere you go, you understand me, Giovanni? Anywhere you go.
Yeah.
You take that flag and you stick it in the dirt.
Yeah.
You know, quote unquote. He says, I don't care who you're dealing with and who you're doing business with. You have to let them know who you are and who you're with before you start doing business. So stick the flag in the dirt. You tell them what you're DiCavalcantes.
Right.
You know, amongst the gangsters.
Right. Right. So there's a whole protocol.
Man. Yeah.
You can't just freelance.
No, you can if you want to. But if you're going to go do work with other Borgatas, you got to let it be known. You can't just then turn around and say, oh, you know, I stuck it to you. I beat you for some cash. Oh, wait a minute. Now I'm with the decavs, you know.
Right.
It doesn't work like that.
Right. Okay.
So when he said that, internally, my emotional roller coaster was, I knew, holy shit, like, I'm in with this guy now. Like, you know. I'm not representing him anymore. I'm representing the Borgata.
Yeah.
So, and the Borgata was a mess at that point, you know, the family.
Yeah. And I guess the Bureau at this point must be
elated.
Yeah.
Elated, right? My supervisor was, rightfully so, I was. And, you know, who knows where this can go, right? When's the last case since Jack Garcia, you know?
Yeah.
Since Jack Garcia, there hasn't been a case like this.
Yeah.
So, you know, and he was with Greg De Palma, you know, one of the most vicious Gambino guys. So, they saw this, and again, I knew Jack's stories.
26-year veteran FBI undercover agent Joaquin Jack Garcia participated in over 100 undercover operations. He's best known for his undercover role as Jack Falcone, a self-described Sicilian jewel thief and drug dealer from Miami, Florida, who penetrated the Gambino family in New York City for over 3 years. The case resulted in the arrest and conviction of 32 mobsters, including top members of the post-John Gotti Gambino family. Garcia, who was born in Cuba and immigrated to the United States at age 9, played his undercover role so convincingly that Gregory De Palma, a high-ranking Gambino family capo, offered him the position of made man. Had Garcia continued in his undercover role, he could have been the first undercover law enforcement to become a made man in a mafia family.
So it almost made me nervous, like, this is not going to end well for me. And my wife told me this is not going to end well for us if you do this.
And she's still in law enforcement.
At the time she was. And she warned me, look, if you do this work, you go back to doing undercover work, not even the Cosa Nostra case. If you go back to doing this work, it's not going to end well for us. It's going to destroy our family, you know, but I just didn't listen because it's my addiction.
Yeah.
And it was what I was good at. It's my trade craft, right?
You're really good at it.
I was good at everything. I was good at homicide. I was good at sex crimes. Anything you gave me, I was great at, but this was my true calling. You know, I loved it. So, so as I represented him and I represented the family, I started going around to different guys, dropping stuff off. And what do you know? Louis came calling. because he hears.
Yeah.
You know, this guy Giovanni's out there in the street running around. So he and I were close to each other in age. And he called me up and he was blowing my phone up, texting me, I got to see you. But again, I'm like, I'm sorry. The FBI says I got to be with Charlie, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of blew him off. And then finally he reached out to an associate of mine. And the associate says, look, this guy, Louis, he won't leave me alone. He wants to see you. I don't know what he wants.
Yeah.
I went and had lunch with him, coffee. And he says, so where you been? And he had this different persona about him, you know, different way. Yeah. I could tell. Yeah. He was dressed, still a soup sandwich, but he was trying to dress a little more polished. Mm-hmm. And he had an attitude about him. And he was like, so where you been? Nah, I've been around. I'm making money, you know. Oh, how come I haven't heard from you? Because you're not my father. I got no reason to call you. I'm making money. What I just told you what I'm doing. Well, you've been out in Vegas. None of your business.
Yeah.
So my attitude is very standoffish for a reason.
Yeah.
And he didn't like it, you know. So unbeknownst to me, he had gotten himself made. Okay. He was now a made guy. He was a soldier in the family.
Mm.
And he went about it the wrong way.
Yeah.
So it was told to me. You know, John Riggi was the boss of the family at the time. He's a, you know, very, very, very well-known gangster throughout all the families across the country.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had a stronghold on all the unions and he thought, hey, listen, I'm John Riggi, you know, I'm the boss of this family. I'll make my own rules.
Yeah.
So when it came to making Louis, John Riggi's son was Louis's captain. So he says, hey, Pop, listen, before you retire and you pass the torch, because he was in his 90s, he says, you know, you should make this kid Louis. You know, he's with me. He's been around this thing his whole life. So, you know, you should make him. So Riggi called him into the room. He says, oh, so you want to meet a guy? Bada bing, bada bip. There you go. You're made.
Whoa.
That's not how you get made. That's not how you get made.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when the other people in the family and the other made guys found him, they wouldn't acknowledge him as being made.
Yeah.
So I knew this because Charlie was explaining this to me.
Yeah. So Louis thought he was made and acting like he was made. And other people were like, nah, this guy's it's not right.
We're not acknowledging him. We're not going to acknowledge him. You know, you get made the way you're supposed to. There's a whole protocol to it.
Right.
So he kind of went around. But it's not Louis's fault. He just kind of, you know, it's like any other thing. And a little bit of nepotism, right? He manipulated. Yeah. He wanted his button. He got his button. So by the time I met him, he had a real chip on his shoulder. And he says, you know, so you've been out in Vegas with Charlie. Yeah. So what? He's like, well, you know, you should be with me. Because again, I was earning, you know.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, Charlie's a good guy, but, you know, he's a crazy. He's nuts. Giovanni, he's crazy. Like, you know, I've seen him do some crazy things and, you know, be careful with him. I said, well, that's who I'm going to be with. The government wants me with him. That's who I'm going to be with. So I went about my business and that kind of, you know, that same day, Louis was like, look, I brought him some Athleta t-shirts that I hijacked. I had a truckload. And I said, look, I got shirts while I'm here, you know. So now he wanted to really win me over.
Yeah.
So as I said, you want to walk to my car and I'll get you these shirts. As he's walking, he now has to double down. And he says, as the three of us, my associate and Louis are walking, he says, look, that stuff you're doing, all this stuff you're buying in the street, meaning narcotics.
Yeah.
He goes, that's all coming from my guys. That's all my guys and my crew.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Why didn't you say something? You know, so now let's renegotiate prices. You know, now that I know it's you,
right,
can I get it cheaper?
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah, that's me. So really what he was doing was really trying to win me over.
Yeah. I want you in my crew, not with Charlie.
Yeah, yeah. So as we had this conversation, my associate, he was very smart. He was, you know, I kind of groomed him up, and he made a smart decision and checked out of that conversation and went and sat in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, that was a smart thing he did.
Mm-hmm.
The not so smart thing he did was he got bored within 3 seconds and started sending on his burner phone. He sent a text to the case agent, just updating him on our status. Basically said, hey, listen, you know, we're with the target. You know, now he calls Louis the target. We're the target, and Giovanni will be done in a couple minutes, and we'll be done. We'll be clear. I mean, that's cop terminology.
Yeah,
it was forced, and he sent it. Problem was, who set up that meeting? He did. Who's the last person he texted? Luigi. Oh, so who did he send that text to?
Oh,
he sent it to Luigi while I was standing there talking to him.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. So that was really bad. So,
yeah.
So. You know, there's not enough time to go into how I mitigated and how we got through, but Louis, he never really let that go. You know, he hung on to that.
Of course, that's going to stick in the back of your mind.
Yeah. Yeah, and it came back to bite me in the ass later.
Yeah.
You know, eventually they threatened to chop me up into pieces and threatened to, you know, to harm me if I was wearing a wire and all kinds of crazy stuff.
And that led to that scene at the car repair place, right?
Yeah, yeah. So Charlie had at that point in the case, Charlie decided he was going to go on record now.
Mm-hmm.
He was really going to step up game. and he's going to let the bosses meet me. And I had a scheduled meet with the underboss of the family and some aide guys. And he put this whole thing together. So if you can imagine, those who were watching and listening, we went to the pork store, you know. We go to the pork store and he says, listen, tomorrow morning, I'm flying to Jersey. What are you coming to Jersey for? I'm going to make everything right. I'm going on record with you.
Yeah.
You know, which doesn't mean I'm a made guy, okay? It just means he's letting everybody know who I am.
Yeah.
So, So he says, you know, dress sharp, be there at this time. So I drove there. And again, I know my way around this neighborhood, like with my eyes closed. I've done surveillance there all for 10, 15 years. And as I come around the corners, I'm calling. He said, where are you? Where, Jesus Christ, what's taking you so long? I said, child, I don't know where I am. Everything's a dead end down here.
Yeah.
So I made him give me directions in, and he sees my car coming around. And as I turn a corner with my Escalade, I come around a corner, and I drove right onto the set of a Sopranos episode. You know, I'm going, oh my God, there's Christopher, there's Paulie Walnuts, there's Big Pussy, you know, and everybody's staying outside. Nobody's inside and they're dressed sharp. So imagine these guys are at this deli and they're dressed to the nines because the boss is coming.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to keep going. I just wanted to hit the gas. I'll be honest, Rob, like, you know, I didn't think I was some super cool guy. I mean,
this is too much. Yeah.
Too much, man. So I wanted to just keep going. And he gives, hey, here I am.
So
I describe, you know, I committed to a parking spot.
Yeah.
And the only thing that decompressed me was, if you're born and raised in a city or lived in a city, parallel parking is everything to us, right? So I committed to this little tiny spot that barely fit my Escalade.
Wow.
And I nailed it in one shot.
Yeah.
I'm born and raised, so I nailed it.
Wow.
By the grace of God. It sounds silly, but it meant everything, because the minute I did it, all you heard was, oh, and the clock came, you know, and here's a proud papa going, that's the way you park.
That's my boy. Look at him. Look at the skill. Yeah,
right. So by the time I get out of the car, I had a bit of a chip. And I go, how you like that? So it kind of de-escalated everything and kind of put everything. And then the kisses, boom, boom, boom. And then, you know, kissing everybody.
Yeah.
And then we walked in. And then we went on record. Charlie sat there and he represented. Wow. And he presented me to the underboss. And as I'm sitting there and I'm trying to look past him, I'm trying to look at him, and he's just straddling over me, you know. And if he got any closer to me, he'd be part of me. And he's just going, so tell me everything you're doing. Tell me what you got going on. And the leg is going a million miles an hour, you know, probably because he's just jacked up on espresso.
Yeah.
And as I'm trying to look at him, I'm looking past him, and there's a bone saw, there's a meat saw, there's a cleaver, there's bloody aprons from the butcher shop, because half of it is a deli.
Right.
You can get pre-made meals and deli meats. And this half is a butcher shop, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought for sure these guys, they gotta drag me down to basement. The Russians had done it in the past. You know, I'm not the first time I've been stripped.
Yeah.
And I'm like, they gotta drag me in the basement. I got five recorders on me.
You got a recorder on you. Yeah.
I got five recorders on me, not one.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
So it's not gonna take much to find these things.
Right.
And just on Charlie's vouch, and you know, I talked, and the underboss turns around, and he says, all right, so you with Charlie, here's my personal number. Anything you need. You know, he says that you're doing good and this and that. Call me, whatever you need in the street. Or if you have any problems with Charlie's out there out west, stay in touch with me. Call me.
Yeah.
And that's that.
Wow.
So because that went so well, Charlie just felt like a proud papa and just paraded me around.
Yeah.
And from that point on, it was like, you know, it was Mafia 10.0.
Rocco Giovanni became the third law enforcement officer ever to be considered for the position of made man in a mafia family. In the late 1970s, Joseph Di Pistone became the first during his infiltration of the Bonanno crime family under the alias Donnie Brasco. Jack Garcia became the second, and had he continued his undercover role, he could have been the first undercover law enforcement officer to become a made man in a mafia crime family. But his FBI supervisors, against Garcia's wishes, decided to terminate the investigation first. And then you describe a scene in the book where, in the first chapter, where Louis really gets pissed off at you, and that gets a little bit hairy.
Yeah. And at this point, I thought, I knew there was a divide in the family by this point.
Yeah.
And I knew that half the family wanted some one person to take the seat, because I told you, John Riggi, the boss, he was stepping down.
Mm-hmm.
And then another faction and another set of crews thought that somebody else should take the seat.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of a divide, and it wasn't going well. And here I am stuck in the middle of this. It's not a war, but it's on the brink of war, right? We were on the brink of war.
Yeah.
And Charlie was no help. You know, he's just poking the bear.
Yeah.
So Louis was on the left side and Charlie's on the right side. And here I am stuck in the middle. So that day that Charlie paraded me around, and you can only imagine it, my anxiety level was just, I was introduced to one of the guys who owned a funeral parlor in town.
Mm-hmm.
And his father was famous for creating the double decker coffins.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, he was famous for that. Like, you know,
yeah,
he would bury the whacked out person under your grandmother. And so I met these guys. Here I am now. I used to be on this side of the camera taking pictures. Now I'm on the other side introducing them and giving these guys kisses.
Right.
You know? So now God only knows I got state and local police watching me out here with cameras taking pictures of me.
Sure, sure. Going, who is this guy? Yeah.
Who's going to recognize me from other cases I worked.
Right.
So Charlie had this brilliant idea. I got in a car with him. He felt like a proud papa and the chest was out and he's feeling his oats. Drive around here. I'll give you a tour of the neighborhood. This guy's with us. This guy's with us. Over here is this guy. Go down this dead end street. Go down a dead end. Make a U-turn. Park the car. Just wait here. I'll be back. Just wait a minute. I'll be right back. And he got out of the car. Now I'm sitting there, you know, I'm wondering where the hell is he?
Yeah.
5 minutes turns into 15 minutes. And, you know, I roll the window down. I'm parked next to a building on a corner. And I got these dogs barking and whatnot going crazy in the basement. And then the light starts getting brighter. And I'm like, wait a minute. He brought me right to Luigi's neighborhood. Like, this is where Louis lives.
Yeah.
Because I know that because I wasn't even paying attention. We had information that Louis used to work tight with the Bloods.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't pay your dues, he'd get the Bloods, bring you down to the basement, he'd throw you in a room with these pit bulls.
Wow.
So that's why I heard the dogs bark.
Wow.
So Charlie drove right to Luigi's house.
Jeez. And he knew that.
He knew what he was doing.
Wow.
So he called him. So what happened was, as Charlie's getting out of the car, he says, I'll be back in a minute. I'll be back. Hey, what are you doing? Come outside. That's all I heard. Come outside. And then he disappears for 5 minutes. He's gone for 15 minutes total. Charlie never came back.
Yeah.
What happened was, from around the corner, Louis emerges. And he looks right at me and he goes, come here.
Yeah.
Now, by this time, he's a made guy.
Yeah.
By this time, Charlie's told me the story about him being made and not being acknowledged.
Yeah.
That doesn't matter. He's still the made guy. So I turn around. I'm like, I still roll the window down. Where's Charlie? Come here. I open the door. Where's Charlie? Like, don't worry about it. Come here.
Yeah.
So now I'm thinking, well, with this war going on, did he
whack Charlie?
Yeah. He doesn't have balls to do that, but who knows? You could be stupid enough.
Yeah.
So all these things are going through my head. I get out and I go to give him a kiss, two kisses, because he's now a made guy. And I say, hey, nothing but good things. I hear, you know, congrats, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Forget all of that. And I knew he always carried a 38. Intelligence was, he always had a snub-nosed 38 on him. And he had all these keys for his apartments that he owned. And he's sitting there with his hands in his pocket. And he just went right off the rails and started yelling at me.
Yeah.
You know, you disrespected me that day. And that, you know, when you said to me, you were Charlie and this and that. I say, Lou, relax.
Yeah.
You know, don't tell me. And your friend with that phone and what he did, your friend did a move I didn't like. And he goes through this whole thing and he says, you know, why didn't he call anybody? He didn't make one phone call to Giovanni.
Yeah.
And he didn't. And I'm like, hey, Lou, I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
I said, I tried to tell you about that. And another thing, forget that. When you left, I went to get my buddy's car because we had surveillance out there. So they had counter surveillance on us that day.
Yeah.
He says, and I had guys out in the parking lot and I went back to the car. And they told me, don't come to the car. You gave me that athletic shirt and a bag. Yeah. He goes, I went in Home Depot, I walked in there. He says, and I came out and they told me, all right, it's okay. The car was driving away. And it turned out there was a girl sitting in the car the whole time. And he says, and my guy said, this girl in this car has been sitting there the whole time you meet with these guys.
Yeah.
He says, you know what? Follow that car.
Yeah.
He says, if this guy's setting me up, I'm going to cut him up into pieces. He says, follow the car. He says, and we followed the car, Giovanni. Guess where we followed the car? I don't know. He says, guess. I don't know. Where'd you follow the car? FBI building.
Mm.
I'm like, oh, what? Shit. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
So now with that, Charlie comes over. He comes back into the picture. So obviously he didn't whack him out.
Yeah.
I'm like, what are you talking about? FBI building, you know? So I'm like, there's no way.
Who is this girl?
Sure as shit. Yeah. So sure as shit, I find out later that it was FBI.
Yeah.
She was followed back and she went into the building and told the other FBI agents that she was followed back. And they never told me.
Oh, great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great. You know, it just slipped in mind.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so
that could have been it right there.
Yeah, yeah, it could have been it right there.
Yeah.
So I made the decision. I had to decide whether, you know, what do I do now?
Yeah.
Did he just tell this crazy story to Charlie on this walk and talk?
Yeah.
And what happens if he did tell Charlie and I don't bring it up? Charlie's going to think, what am I not telling him?
Yeah.
So when we got my escalator, you know, the meeting ended.
Yeah.
The meeting ended on a good note because I kind of de-escalated and I said, look, you know, I'm with him now. We're all in the same family. I don't know why we can't get along. Like, I'm going to be with him. I'm always going to be with him.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean you and I can't do business, right? Because greed is everything.
Right.
I said, Lou, let's get back to making money together. You and me, we were good at it.
Yeah.
He goes, yeah. All right. Listen, I didn't like it, but I just wanted to tell you that. So I didn't know if it was the two of them testing me, Ralph.
Yeah.
You know, and they're colluding us up to something. I don't know to this day.
Yeah.
But I don't think they were. I think Louis, see, the things that I said to Louis was, and I told you, your emotional intelligence is everything in the art that I did with undercover work.
Yeah.
I knew Louis had never been arrested. I knew he didn't even got a parking ticket.
Yeah.
See, by this point, he knew I was in prison. By this point, he knew I was arrested for attempted murder. He knew I was a bad dude.
Yeah.
So when I said to him, listen, man, that guy that did with Tommy, the guy that did that with the phone, he's not like me and you.
Yeah.
He's never done nothing bad.
Yeah.
You understand? He's not like me and you.
Yeah.
So when I said that, I go, he's never done nothing bad. He's never been in prison before. He's not like us.
Yeah.
The minute I said prison, his shoulders dropped.
Yeah.
And I knew I had him because he knew, like, you know, he's like, oh shit, this guy's a badass and I've never been to prison.
Right.
But he didn't share that with me.
Right.
So I kind of played it up and he goes, well, you know, we can get back to making money. You still got cigarettes? Yeah, I got cigarettes. He goes, you got any Newports? Nah, I got Marlboro Reds. And I said, you want some? And I was selling to him for like 2,100 a case, really cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, all right, yeah. How much? Is the price the same? Nah, price went up, 2,900 a case. And he laughs on the tape and he goes, I bet. But he knew what I did.
Yeah.
He knew that I taxed his ass.
Yeah, yeah.
For saying what you said.
Yeah.
And that's what a gangster would do.
Right.
If I just said, oh, come on, Lou, let's be friends.
Yeah, you're my buddy. I'll give you a break.
Let's hug it out.
Yeah.
And I did this and I taxed his ass in front of Charlie.
Yeah.
And when I said it, and I said, see, the price was a good price, but I got to tax your ass. It's the street.
Yeah.
I said, it's just a street tax, Lou. You can get back to that same number, but I got to tax your ass.
Wow.
And he knew.
Wow.
So Charlie, there goes the chest, you know, proud papa. When we got back in the truck, I realized, you know, I'm going to tell Charlie.
Yeah.
So I told him.
Yeah.
I told him about the FBI and I did.
Yeah.
And thank God I did. And he says, that's wild. It's a wild story I heard.
He had heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he goes, that's wild. He says, yeah, they did the same thing to me a little while back.
Mm.
They accused me of being in my nephew's apartment, rah-rah, and trying to kill this guy and, you know, with a bunch of shooters.
Yeah.
And he shared that with me. So at that point, he made a comment. He says, look, I got through it just like you got through it. You understand?
Yeah.
And then he whispers and he goes, there's always a time and there's always a place. You understand? Louis wearing a hat that's too big for his head.
Wow.
He thinks he's a made guy.
Wow.
And I understood what he was saying. He says, but there's always a time and there's always a place.
Wow.
Fast forward a few months, Charlie shared with me that the family had decided that Louis was acting out of sorts and he was to be eliminated.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, yeah, we went to dinner and he shared a story with me and said, so the administration, the administration decided that, he's no more.
Yeah.
They're going to clip him.
Yeah.
They're going to kill him. They're going to kill him just like that. You know this guy your whole life.
Yeah.
So by this point, I could say these things. My relationship with Charlie almost turned, it was father son at this point.
Right.
You know,
so you could share anything.
I could share anything. I could walk into his house if I wanted to.
Wow.
You know, I didn't have to ring the bell. He was standing outside, you know.
Hey,
go use the bathroom upstairs. Use this, use that. He was making me coffee. He was making me food and, you know, his wife.
Yeah.
And it was really like a family.
Yeah. And his wife, you became close to his wife who also had a contact in law enforcement.
Yeah, she wound up being, she had contact in law enforcement. Yeah. That was crazy. She told me when you go back home, you know, don't talk to Jimmy Dirt. Don't call Jimmy Dirt. That's what you're talking about. You know, she said, no, he's going to get arrested. And sure as anything, you know, she was the leak.
Wow.
You know, she had worked for law enforcement for years and she shared that with me as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
She had a friend in law enforcement.
Yeah.
So, you know, here I am looking at, you know, arrest warrants for people.
God.
It was crazy.
Crazy,
you know, before they even signed copies of
them. Yeah. Such a treacherous world, man.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And at the same time, you're raising a family. So you've got kids
at the same time. Yeah.
You've got a wife and she's complaining like, hey, when is this going to end?
Sure.
I'm worried about you, which any loving wife would be.
Mm-hmm.
I can see it. It's on your mind all the time. And then you end up going to a soccer game.
Yeah. You know, I finally got some downtime. And again, to her prediction, you know, it overwhelmed me and took me over. I would spend a lot of time out in Vegas and a lot of time. By that point, you know, I was kind of like, I was coming home as much as I could.
Yeah.
My thing was, when I'm home, I decompress.
Yeah.
I just want to be with my family and spend quality time.
Sure.
So it was a weekend. It was a soccer tournament. My youngest daughter was playing soccer. And here I am on a soccer field. And, you know, I finally had a chance to just let it all out. Just put on my shorts, put on my sneakers, relax, just not be Giovanni Gatto.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting between games. You know, it was one of those tournaments where it's, you play multiple games in a day.
Yeah, sure.
You know, true to form, she's got the, you know, it's the first tournament they ever put her name on her back. You know, she's a little kid and they got the names on her back. And so everything lined up was against me. So I'm sitting in these chairs and my mother and father are visiting. So they're able to go to their granddaughter's game and everything's great. We're eating sandwiches between games. And I look up and that don't look like Danny Gooms. That guy looks just like Danny Gooms. Like we say Gooms, right? Yeah. Like Goombada, Ralphie Gooms, my Goombada. So that's it. So, hey, looks like Gooms is coming right at me. Like, so Gooms, I would meet this guy occasionally. Charlie would tell me, go meet this guy, meet that guy. So this guy, I knew his car. I was always in it, you know, meeting this guy and having lunch with him when I could. Man,
and he was a Gambino, or
he was a Gambino, yeah,
yeah.
And here he comes, walking right at me, and he's on his phone, and as he's playing with the phone, he's looking up at me and looking right at me, and I'm like back on the phone.
Yeah,
and I'm saying, man, he's texting somebody. He sees me. He's, yeah. Who's he texting? Is he texting Charlie? Is he texting his? You know, the guy he reported to is the guy who ran the Gambinos from Jersey.
Yeah,
and I'm like, man, who's he calling? So I decided to get up and flank him.
Yeah,
so I flanked him around. And my wife and I always had an understanding that, you know, if anything happens or she and I met somebody we bump into, just walk away.
Yeah.
You know, I'm with the kids, you're with the kids, just walk away.
Yeah.
If you have to. And we'll regroup later.
Yeah.
So thank God she remembered it, because when I flanked him, I didn't say anything to her.
Yeah.
She sees me just leave and I get up and I say, hey, Gooms. And he turns around and looks, Giovanni, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
Nothing. Man, I got to kiss him twice because he's, you know.
Yeah.
So I go in for the kiss. And when my wife sees the kiss, she's like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
All right. So she goes to grab my kids.
She picks up on it right away.
Yeah. So, and my youngest guy culturally is very Italian.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He's, you know, if the boy could have been drinking espresso at the age of four, he would, you know, he just embraced and immersed himself in the Italian culture.
Yeah. I have a son.
So when he
like
sees
that,
his dad, just, you know, it's everything to him and familiar to him. So he wanted to be part of that. And I felt bad because here she is pulling away. And thank God he went, daddy, daddy. And he wasn't screaming to me.
Yeah.
But she just grabbed him.
Yeah.
And grabbed my daughter and just left.
Yeah.
So here I am in the middle of the field talking to this guy. She leaves. My poor parents are just sitting in these two chairs like, you know, where's everybody going?
What the hell? We smell bad or something? Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
right. Yeah. So I, you know, I give him the acknowledgement. He said, what are you doing here? You don't have kids.
Yeah.
Hold on. And it quickly took a turn for the worse. And he goes, puts his finger on my chest and he goes, are you following me? Are you following me?
Yeah.
Why are you here?
Yeah.
You live in New York.
Yeah.
Why are you in New Jersey? Why are you in Monroe, New Jersey on a Sunday? You know?
Yeah.
He goes, what are you talking about? We talk about all this all the time. I know you do this soccer thing, but I told you when we were talking about his daughter play soccer. And I said, you know, you told me about your daughter playing soccer. And I told you about the little girl. My old girlfriend's kid, I taught her how to play soccer and I always promised her I would come to the games.
Yeah.
I just pulled the story out of my ass. And he goes, no, you didn't. You never told me that.
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I told you. We had this conversation. Every time you bring up soccer.
Yeah.
Because he always brought up soccer.
Yeah.
And he goes, I said, every time I told you about the little girl, her father's in the can. I taught her. I said, I went through this. I'm not even going to repeat it again. Because see, this is it. You don't listen to anything I say. You talk.
You turn it back on him.
You turn it back on him. And he goes, holy shit, well, I don't remember that. All right, whatever. But she's playing here today? Yeah, yeah, she's playing on the other field.
Yeah.
She's over there. She's done. He goes, oh, what team? I don't know. Some team down in South Jersey. They came up for this. And he goes, all right. Ah, that's good. And he says, I said, Gooms, now I know why you can't meet me on the weekends. Oh, forget about it, G-Bine. The fucking, this thing just controls. This is what I said to you. Every time you want to meet me on a weekend, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And we had a good laugh. And I said, I got to get out of here.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
He says, all right. So he calls his daughter over. to say hello to me.
Yeah.
Because I knew her at that point. And he said, hey. So she came over and I said hello. And I said, oh, is she playing again? Yeah, yeah, she's playing this team over here. My daughter's team.
Jeez.
You know, you couldn't if you tried. So I realized, all right, let me get out of here. I'll see you later. Kiss, kiss, goodbye.
Yeah.
I got to go.
Yeah.
I got to go find my car in a sea of cars. I feel like I parked in Disneyland. Oh, forget about it. We had a good laugh and off I go.
Right.
My wife, I called my wife. I said, listen, just, you know, I got to go. I can't stay.
Yeah.
And she was a nervous wreck, like rightfully so.
I'm sure.
And she was like, look, these people looking at me. Now she got paranoid, you know.
Yeah.
And she did undercover work, but now she's got it in her head like they're looking at us.
Right, right.
You know, his wife is looking at me. And,
right.
You know, I think they're focused. And I said, just relax. I said, just send my father to come get me. Tell him I'm walking on a main road. I just, you know, just tell him to come in his truck and pick me up. So you got to understand it. My father, I always describe my father. Robert De Niro and Al Pacino had a baby together. That's my father. He looks like Robert De Niro. And he talks and yells like Al Pacino. So he pulls over on the side of the road, sees me walking. I jump in the car. I said, just take me home. He goes, what are you doing? What's the matter with you people? You know, what are you guys doing? It's nothing. I just, listen, just take me home. I bumped into somebody I shouldn't have. And he wouldn't let me. He wouldn't let up on it. So finally, I said, look, for the last couple of years, I've been in the mafia and I've been doing this. And he says, you people are out of your mind. Does she know about this? I said, yeah. He goes, you effing people. The two of you are stupid. You know, you're idiots. So
thanks,
we got through that.
Thanks,
yeah.
Dad. Yeah. Yeah.
So by that point, it was no more family time.
Yeah.
There was no going out in public anymore.
Yeah.
If I did go out to dinner, it would be, I'll meet you there with the kids.
Yeah.
You know, you advance, sit down, and then I'll kind of,
I'll
slaunter in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was bad from that point on. All the responsibility fell on her.
Yeah.
You know, on top of her career, she's got to drop kids off at daycare, pick them up, do this, do that. And now I'm not coming home. Right. And anybody's dream would turn into, you go to New York and you go to Vegas and, you know, live in your little three-story walk up and, you know, hang out with your models in New York and, you know, go out to Vegas and hang out with your gangster buddies. So,
yeah,
that didn't go all the well.
And you're really close to Charlie at this point. You're like, he calls you his son at this point.
Yeah. By this point, he had his son answering to me.
Yeah.
He built, you know, we built a crew. He was building a crew. I was running a crew. Guys were reporting back to me.
Yeah.
Anything we did, anything our crew did with anybody else's crew in the family, I would make sure I paid kick up to my skipper. Mm-hmm. And I even made it so where other skippers, I would pay them their kick up because I would say, Charles.
Yeah.
No, don't worry about it. Just let him pay his own skipper. He's got his Don. Let him pay his Don. I said, no, listen, if he accuses me of not giving him the whole money, or I don't want it to ever be a problem. So call your Goombada and tell him, you know, I'm coming to drop this money off at his house.
Yeah.
So I had, you know, Charlie would make phone calls to me and say, yeah, my kid's coming to drop money off. So now I'm answering to multiple skippers, like multiple captains. Like,
yeah.
It was crazy.
So you're really in tight.
Yeah. So I was in tight. So the conversations were, do you like my kid? Yeah. Kid's a good kid. You know, kid's a good kid. Polished. You know, I see why you want him now. And then it would turn into, yeah. So-and-so likes you. So-and-so thinks you're, you know, a good kid. And then we went to dinner one night out and I had a really good score. And I went to pay kick up to him. And I took him out to dinner at a really high-end restaurant inside the Mandalay Bay out in Vegas. And he basically shared with me. Yeah. So they're going to. It's not going to end well for Louis. The administration decided he's got to go.
Yeah.
Wow. What does that mean? Like, you know, go where? Like, you know, not going to kill him. Gonna clip him. Yeah. I said, yeah. But after you know this kid for so long, like, man, that's the way it is, Giovanni. You know,
the business. Yeah.
So I said, wow. Okay. I said, well, you know, he hasn't been all that good to me. He threatened to chop me up and whatnot. He goes, and so that's how it's going to be. And I told him that you would do it. I would do what? He says, yeah. I told him that you would. You're going to kill him. You're going to take care of him. Oh, okay. And the minute I hesitated and said, okay, I didn't say yes. I didn't say no. I said, oh, okay. I was just processing it.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, like a shark's eyes.
Yeah, sure.
And he goes, you got a problem with that?
Yeah.
No, Charlie, you know, I'm a capable guy. Like, you know, I'm not, you know, I've done things. I haven't even told you what I've done in the past. I know what you've done in the past.
Yeah.
You don't know what I've done in the past. Yeah. He goes, no, listen, be the man you were born to be. Be the man that I taught you to be.
Wow.
You do this,
and
you know, and this is how it's going to be.
Yeah.
So I introduced the, you know, I said, okay, so who do you want me to use? You want me to use your kid, you know, your son? You want me to use our crew? No. You can't use your, don't use these kids. They're too young.
Yeah.
He says, so I kind of guided him along and I said, well, you know, this kind of work I used to do with my friends. You know what? That Louis, he should meet my friends, you know?
Yeah.
You know, they'd really be a big fan of his for accusing me. Who's that? Who's that? And I said, well, the bikers.
Yeah.
And he came up with this whole thing. You should use them.
Yeah.
Use them, guys. It's outside of our family. So he came up with this whole thing. And for the next few months, we planned and planned and planned. And, you know, and then finally I told him, yeah, he started getting antsy, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's just walking. If he's in the coffee shop, just walk in the coffee shop. Boom, boom, boom. Kill him and walk out. Walk the fuck. You know.
Yeah.
Very matter of fact. And I said, sure. Well, you know, what do you want me to do if he's in there with somebody else? Well, you don't have to kill everybody unless you're going to throw. He always talked about military grade, like a grenade.
Yeah.
He says, unless you're going to throw a grenade. No. You got to throw a grenade. In a social club.
Yeah.
You know what you're thinking, man? This ain't 1972. So, but he was like, yeah, just, you know, if you walk in there. You know, if anybody else is in, just try to, if they get snippy with you, if they get chesty, shoot them in the leg, you know, shoot them in the leg, but then, you know, kill him. Boom, boom, boom. Just walk in. Everybody knows who you are.
Yeah.
Tough guy. Boom, boom. Walk out. Just walk the F out, you know?
Yeah.
And he really wanted to be there, but he would look out for me so much so that he'd say, listen, get a car.
Yeah.
Get another car, park it out of the area. You know, go car to car, use this, use that.
Right.
You know, you got to be careful of the bulls and be careful of this.
Yeah.
Because that's how he got pinched in 1982. And he didn't want the same thing to happen to me.
Wow.
So, yeah. So that, you know, that kind of, it can't, I knew everything was coming to an end.
Yeah.
But I didn't want it to, because shortly thereafter, while we were planning it, I would always challenge him and say, Charles, how does this leave me? You know, what do you mean? Well, they're all going to look at me.
Yeah.
Like the whole family is going to look at me like, you know, there's basically a war happening and they're all going to look at me. They're going to come for me. He goes, what are you talking about? They're not going to come for you. They're going to be standing 50 deep to pin medals on your chest.
Hmm.
This comes from the administration, Giovanni. This is not coming from me. This is sanctioned.
Right.
So I was like, all right. And I'd always challenge him.
Yeah.
So finally, one day we were in his house and he jacked up the volume on the TV. And all he kept saying, he explained to me that he was going to go up. He was getting made probably to number two when he came off paper, when he came off parole. And then he finally admitted to me, this is a good thing for you. You'll get made.
Yeah.
If I go up, and he used to, you know, I had to get him to say it on tape because he was going, if I go up, you go. And I was like, what does that mean? You know, but again, this social, you know, a psychopath, he's like, hey, listen, I don't know what you're saying.
What are you
know?
Charlie,
and he would get, Jesus Christ. And finally, you know, he grabs the remote and I grabbed the remote and I lowered it. I said, just say what you want to say. I don't understand what you're saying. Jesus, this kid's, what's the matter with this kid? Is he stupid? And he's talking to him.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to get up then and you'll get proposed and you'll get your button. Oh, okay. All right. Now I got it on tape. Now we're good.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. So you can never forget. You can never forget what you need on to capture on tape. To make a case,
everything is you got so many spots in your brain that are working and wheels and cogs and you got your frontal lobe and you know whatever's going on in your frontal lobe and your body just wants to shut down and just collapse and sweat. You have to it's not easy work at all.
No, not at all. You're completely in it, 100%. And you have to be.
You do. You do. You know, so much so as after it was over, you know, and the arrest came down and. You know, it was very hard for me to detach myself from it. Right.
Yeah. You know, very hard. I would imagine. Yeah. I would imagine. I mean, it's like an actor playing a part for a year or 3 years and suddenly it's gone.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, who am I now? Now what do I do?
And I have great respect for everything I went through mentally after the case came down. It was great work and the Bureau celebrated and everybody did their thing. But then all of a sudden, next thing you know, like, what did I do wrong? Why am I sitting in my house for 9 months and I can't leave to go to the office and I can't be a cop or I can't be an investigator anymore?
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Those guys got out on bail.
Yeah.
And they can leave their house. They're sitting at home like me, like, you know, so I started getting angry.
Yeah.
And then my wife was the one when I wrote the book and my co-author had interviewed her and she wrote that paragraph or that little statement that she put in there.
Yeah.
That really opened my eyes because I see how her emotional maturity is far beyond mine because for her to look at it and process it, I learned so much from what she said.
Yeah.
Charlie, I understood that Charlie was a good, bad guy and I was the good guy. I never lost sight of that. Okay.
Right. Right.
But I cared for him. Right.
Yeah, sure.
If I didn't care for him and I didn't come to care for the people who said they loved me and I didn't feel some glimmer of guilt.
Yeah.
For what I was doing, the treachery or the, you know, it is the art of deception, but it's also you. For me, it's very the cultural aspect.
Yeah.
a lot of people I identify with because they were like my own family.
Right. Right.
And the things that they did and the way they moved and the things they said and the way they looked out for me and they fed me, you know, yeah, that it didn't lull me to sleep, but it takes.
Well, it's like, you know, people in your own family who are not so good and do things that are not so good, but you still, they're part of your family. You still love them.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I never lost sight.
Yeah.
Holly and his wife would kill me and bury me in their backyard in a minute.
Right. You know what I mean? Right. If you betrayed them. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But she, my wife compared it to as if, you know, Giovanni suffered a death, as if you, you know, somebody is in your life one day and the next minute they're not. And
that's right.
Here's a man. Charlie wasn't just a complete murdering psychopath. He was a good man.
Yeah.
You know, there was a piece in that as a good man. It's just, he chose this life and his life takes his piece of you.
Yeah.
He would say to me, listen, you know, take two bottles with you. It's hot out here in Vegas. I got water back at the hotel. No, come on, my boy. You know, my boy. You know, carry on, my boy. What are you doing, my boy? Yeah, he was happy I was making money for him. But at the same time, he was like, look, when you land, when you get back to New York, just call me, you know. And he go, not that anything bad is going to happen to you. I just want to know you got there safe. I worry about you when you travel, you know, you travel.
Right.
And, you know, if that didn't touch you, you know.
Of course. Of course.
So.
Well, it's a very human thing. And it's the only reason you were successful is that you could get so close to them and they had feelings for you. You had feelings for them.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, they know in the back of their minds that they're doing something wrong too.
Oh, without a doubt.
And that if they screw up, they go to prison.
Right.
That's the game.
Sure. Sure. And then the last conversation I had with him was, you know, listen, I'm going to go back. We got him. We pinned him down. I got it all figured out. We did surveillance on him and, you know, we got him at the, we know when, what his pattern of going to the club is. We got him tomorrow night's going to be tonight.
Yeah.
And he couldn't be more excited. He's all right. This is good, good, good stuff. Good stuff. Well, just call me when it happens. All right. And, you know, come here, give me a kiss. I love you. I love you. I'm proud of you. You know, and part of me was, you know, I often describe it and some people criticize me for it, but I got in that Cadillac and, you know, the one I had out in Vegas and I'm backing out of his driveway and he's sitting there and he's, you know, waving to me and, you know, saying like your father or like your uncle would say goodbye to you when you leave their house on a holiday. And the only thing is we're going to murder somebody this night. No. You know, part of me wanted to be like, Chuck, come here, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Listen,
yeah.
Go back in the house right now. They're going to come here tomorrow morning, kick your door in, you know, like,
right.
call the U.S. attorney. Not that I would say run. You know, I just want to say, listen, Chuck, you know, get ahead of this. You know what I mean?
Right.
Get ahead of it. You deserve better, you know? Because it's not like he's just going around killing innocent people like a serial killer. Listen, they took this oath, you know? I'm not saying murder is right, but
yeah,
they took this Omerta and Cosa Nostra life, and they...
Hey,
that's
the way it goes, right, man.
It's the way it goes in that life.
We didn't make the rules.
Right.
We didn't make the rules. It's that's the game, man.
Without
that's
a doubt.
The game. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So from that point on, I put my life back together and it took me long. It took me years because that ended my career. So I was relocated.
That was it.
Yeah, that was it.
That was the end of undercover.
That was it.
Wow.
That was the end of my career. And our careers ended. And it was from that point on planning our life and, you know, going into hiding for a while, a long time, and just putting our life back together and then putting my family through that, putting my kids through that, you know, jumping around safe houses and moving here and moving there and, you know, and playing that, pretending that you're on vacation and your kids don't even know what's going on, you know. So while they paid a price and did their sentence of prison time or probation,
right,
I was sentenced as well because my whole family was sentenced. So
sure.
It didn't end all that well for me. You know, it's I want to celebrate it and say it was a great case. It was therapeutic for me to write the book.
Yeah.
But it was more important. I wanted to share the story because of the risks that I took. That's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, that's rough. And how do you anticipate that going into it? You have no idea.
No, you can't. You can't.
Yeah.
Because again, the deep cover is something else, right? You don't know how long deep cover is going to be. It could be 9 months like I did in the beginning.
Yeah.
Undercover work is different. But this level of deep cover, undercover work, and again, I talked to my saving grace is Jack Garcia.
Because
when I felt like, what did I do wrong? Was it something I did? And then when I connected with Jack and he reached out to me and he says, look, G, you know, welcome to the club. There's only two of us that, you know, made it this far. And, you know, like, yeah, there's been other undercovers that have made it.
Yeah,
but not as far as Jack and I did, and you know, here I was thinking it wasn't about how far I made it into the mafia. I was good with not being made.
Yeah,
I didn't care that, you know, I wasn't that guy. Yeah, would I want to be a made guy? Sure. Would I have been made? I think I would have been, and it would have been tremendous. But at that point, my mature undercover life. Listen, so what? I didn't make it. Leave it for another undercover. Maybe 10, 15 years from now, some young kid will come along and he'll get his button. I don't know.
Right.
It's not meant to be.
Right.
And Jack was the one who really talked me off the ledge with that, because he was like, look, you didn't do anything wrong.
No.
You know, they do this to everybody. It's just a government way. And
that's right.
You know, you're an asset and you're a tool in the toolbox. And when they're done with you, they just come, you know, and you have to come to grips with that, right?
That's right. They do it to soldiers every day, man.
They do. They do, yeah. And it's funny you say that, because it led me to the speaking circuit and then led me into working in mental health and addiction, where that's my passion now.
Yeah.
I set up first responder and veteran programs because of that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the Bureau, they had me doing a lot of speaking engagements for them and teaching. And I was doing a lot of education for military and for intelligence. And, mm-hmm. you know, they really shipped me out all over the place and kept me busy.
Yeah.
But they're not employing me. You know, they're not paying me. So the minute I was like, well, now what do I do?
Yeah.
You know, I don't have a paycheck coming in, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. But again, man plans, God laughs. Because everything I do now and everything I do today and paying it forward and paying it back and all the experiences and trauma and stress I put on my family is the same trauma and stress you said as a soldier or any first responder puts on their family. You know, they asked me to start mentoring these folks and just sharing, because like you said, I'm very raw in what I experienced. And
yeah.
if it could help somebody else, you know, because again, we come in with nothing and we leave with nothing. Right?
That's for sure. Interestingly, just last question, like The Sopranos had been out already while you were running this case.
Yeah.
And I'm sure all these guys are probably watching the shows too. Like, well, are they interested in the guys inside?
Sure. When the Sopranos premiered, there was a tape made inside of a car with the then boss. I think it was Vinny Oceans was the boss of the family, the DiCavalcantes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a bug in the car, and they recorded him after the first episode premiered. And he was like, hey, did you watch that show last night? That Sopranos show? Like, that's us.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's this is so-and-so. This is supposed to be this. Yeah, that. Yeah, he laid it out.
Yeah.
So, but again, it's funny you say that, because I just talked about this on a show I'm hosting. And The Sopranos, like, I would follow gangsters when I was doing investigations into the mob guys. They would go to the premiere parties.
Crazy.
All the families, like May guys, captains and above, would go to these parties and take their pictures with these Sopranos guys. Yeah. Yeah. They loved it, you know, because that's the only way they could be in the public eye. But
right.
Yeah. But and again, for me, it was hard because James Gandolfini had passed away during this case.
Yeah.
And I think I write about it in a book, because when I came home, I was trying to decompress, and they were giving tributes to him on HBO, and they were just showing the old episodes over and over.
Yeah.
So here, whether I was at home in my true family or I was in my apartment in New York, I turned on the TV and here's another tribute. But how do you not watch The Sopranos, right?
Like, right.
Had me watch a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
But it was the one episode, it was the day, actually it was right, really close to the day, the pork store story I told you about when I met the bosses.
Mm-hmm.
And I had come home, and they played that episode where Tony was feeling weak after he got shot and came back, and he wound up beating the hell out of the one guy.
Yeah.
Just felt weak. You know, I was like, these are the guys that I'm around. Like, that's what I'm afraid of. Like, somebody's going to see me as a threat. Luigi's going to see me as a threat. Charlie might see me as a threat and make an example. Because I've seen that growing up. I knew my own guys from the life as a kid, and I saw the things they would do to send a message or prove a point.
Today, the DiCavalcanti crime family is a shadow of its former self, thanks to the efforts of Giovanni and others in law enforcement. Most of its leaders are dead or incarcerated, and other criminal networks have wrested control of the rackets that once provided their main source of revenue. Ironically, the success of the hit show The Sopranos coincided with their decline. Giovanni, once a member of the FBI National Covert Operations Unit, continues to share his experiences and provide training to law enforcement agencies as well as military intelligence branches within the United States and internationally. I urge all of you to read his exciting and critically acclaimed book, Giovanni's Ring, My Life Inside the Real Sopranos. I thank him for his bravery and service to our country. It's my great honor to name former FBI undercover agent Giovanni Rocco as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Fazzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.